So we've been practicing here at the temple in our Ango retreat for a few days now. We've heard a few talks about koans, which is the topic of this particular retreat, koans that are meaningful or inspirational to the teachers who are giving the talks. And the koan that I want to talk about tonight is one of my all-time Hip Parade favorites. In fact, we thought maybe we'd rename the retreat the Hip Parade of Koans. And for those of you who don't know anything about koans, just briefly, they're stories or dialogues that were collected. Most of them that we study in Boundless Way Zen were collected in China, probably in the 12th and 13th centuries. Stories, sayings, and doings of masters who lived in the centuries before that. And they were used to illustrate teaching points. I've said a few times already, but I'd like to say it, that in a way, koans are gossip. They're people hearing things that other people talked about and repeating them and saying, did you hear what happened at that monastery? Can you believe that? What was going on there? And teachers took up these stories, these almost folkloric stories, to challenge their own students to gain insight. So sometimes when we first hear a koan, it's a little bit hard to understand what it's about. This one in particular is a little bit hard, and I'll explain some of the more strange and esoteric parts of it after I finish reading through it for the first time. And then I'll go over some of it in a little bit more detail. But the way to listen to a koan is not with your intellect, but with your heart. So there might be a few places in here where you feel touched or you feel moved. Or for me, I think this particular koan is hilarious. So you might find that to be also true. It's case number 73 in the Blue Cliff Record. And in the Blue Cliff Record, there's often an introduction by one of the collectors, Yuan Wu. Then there's the story itself. And then there's a poem by a commentator, Shui Dao. So this is Yuan Wu's introduction to case 73 in the Blue Cliff Record. Preaching is non-preaching and non-teaching. Hearing is non-hearing and non-attaining. If preaching is non-preaching and non-teaching, what use is there in preaching? If hearing is non-hearing and non-attaining, what use is there in hearing? But this non-preaching and non-hearing are worth something. You are listening to me now, preaching here. How can we escape that criticism? Those who have eyes see the following. And here's the koan. A monk said to great master Matsu, independent of the four propositions and transcending the 100 negations, tell me plainly the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West. Matsu said, today I'm tired and I cannot tell you. Why don't you ask Jizang about it? So the monk asked Jizang, who said, why don't you ask the master? And the monk said, he told me to ask you. Jizang said, today I have a headache, and I cannot tell you about it. Ask Brother Hai. The monk asked Brother Hai, who said, coming to this point, I do not understand. The monk told this to Matsu, who said, oh, one's head is white, the other's head is black. So this is Shuido's verse. Jizang's head is white and Hai's head is black. It defies understanding. Ma's horses trampled over the world. Lin Ji wasn't a good daylight robber. Putting aside the four propositions, the 100 negations, in heaven above and earth below, I am the only one. So a couple of things about this koan. At least one of you laughed a little bit. I love the playfulness of this koan. I love how everyone seems to be cooperating in trying to help that monk understand his question, but not in the ordinary sense of helping someone to understand a question. This great master Ma was a very famous Zen master. He lived in the 8th century, and he had, it's said, I wrote down the number because I kind of couldn't believe it, 139 disciples who became Zen teachers. He had thousands of other disciples. We don't know what happened to them, but 139 of them, yes, became Zen masters. And we hear of two of them here. One of them is Jizang, who was fairly well known as a teacher. The other was Brother Hai, who was the teacher who later came to be called Baijiang, a very famous teacher, many stories told about Baijiang. And many stories told about Ma, who partly because he had so many disciples, perhaps there was a lot of gossip about him, and people told endless stories about things that Ma said and did. So these people are highly evolved people. And if you hear this story, as I did when I first heard it, as just a little game that everybody's playing in the monastery with this poor monk who gets sent from one place to another, yearning for answers to a question that must have concerned him quite a bit, then you're a little off the point, because it's not a game. It's actually a very serious encounter between teachers, students, people of the way, and the part of us that inquires, that wants to know, that wants to come to understand the great truth of the matter. The four propositions and the 100 negations appear in a couple of koans, to my knowledge. When I was very young, when I was 18 years old, I took a course at university called Emptiness. And I consider myself pretty lucky because it was my first real exposure to Buddhism. I was taught by a wild and wacky religion professor who was also a friend of David's, although I didn't know David then. But he had just returned from Japan. He wanted to teach us all how to meditate, and he wanted to teach us some of the most fundamental teachings of Indian Buddhism and Chinese Buddhism and Japanese Buddhism. So we read a lot of stuff. And one of the books we read was a commentary on the teachings of Nagarjuna, who was an Indian teacher who probably wasn't a Zen teacher, but the Zen school incorporated him into its fake history. And Nagarjuna is considered one of our Zen ancestors. Nagarjuna is the person who came up with the four propositions and the 100 negations. And I was lucky enough today to just come across a description in another book about them. And I want to read this description to you about the four propositions and the 100 negations, partly because I'm curious about how you'll experience it. So I'm going to invite you, as I read it, to just notice what happens as you hear this to your body as you hear it, maybe to your emotional field, to your heart, and to your mind. You might start having all kinds of interesting phenomena arise. You might have all kinds of interesting thoughts arise. The primary thought that I had, I'll give you a little hint, is, what? So, this is an explanation by Thomas Juho Kirchner. It's found in another collection of koans called Entangling Vines. The four propositions and the 100 negations are formulations in Indian logic. The four propositions are identity, difference, being, and non-being. The 100 negations comprise the sum total of the various ways in which these propositions may interrelate. Each proposition may be affirmed, negated, both affirmed and negated, or neither affirmed nor negated, resulting in four. This applies to all four of the original propositions, resulting in 16. These 16 exist in the three worlds, past, present, and future, resulting in 48. These 48 have either arisen or are about to arise, resulting in 96. To the 96 are added the original 4, resulting in 100, since all are hypothetical and thus non-actual. They are referred to as the 100 negations. So your honest response to that little section is, in my mind, the heart of Zen practice. Zen practice, which really arose in China as the seed of Indian Buddhism came to China and interacted with Confucianism and Taoism, which were already pretty firmly established in Chinese culture, and created what we now call Zen, or in those days in China it was called Chan. Zen is the Japanese pronunciation. There was a turning away from a rejection of the kind of philosophy that I just read to you. It's kind of interesting, and maybe your response to hearing all that was, oh man, I want to know more about that. That's really cool. And if so, you can speak to us later and we'll direct you elsewhere. but it's kind of wonderful, and some people it's their taste, so you don't have to feel bad if you liked it, if you thought, oh, that's great, that's just the way I feel. But this monk in the story, he knew this teaching. You know, these people were living, I don't know, so it was the 8th century, so it was really just a few generations from when Bodhidharma supposedly brought Zen to China from India and brought all these kinds of teachings about the 4 propositions and 100 negations. But Bodhidharma and all the teachers who followed him were adamant that the truth of reality is found in this moment, not in philosophy or in logic. And because I was university educated in the United States of America, and I imagine many of you were, I was first attracted to some of the ideas in Buddhism. But when I came to Zen practice in my late 20s, I was so excited to find that I didn't need to be bothered with those things anymore. What I needed to be preoccupied with was my own experience moment to moment, the experience of long periods of time spent sitting, facing whatever reality was arising. So the 4 propositions and the 100 negations might be a nice frame for some folks, and it's a wide and wonderful world, so there are teachings for everybody. But the Zen teaching, the Zen world, points to something beyond that. And this monk is actually asking that. He's asking beyond all that, taking that not into account, turning away from that. I want to know something. I want to know why Bodhidharma came from the West. And Bodhidharma, as I mentioned a little earlier, is the man who supposedly brought Zen from India to China. I say supposedly because there's a lot of scholarly evidence that he may have not existed, so he can take his place in one of the 100 negations. But he exists in my heart, certainly, and he existed in the hearts and minds of centuries of people who were developing Chan in China throughout the centuries, all the way up to the 8th century, which is what we're talking about in this story. So the question, why did he come from the West? Why did he come from India to China? Is a way of asking, what is this all about? It's like a code word, code phrase for, I want to know the truth. Tell me the truth. Tell me about reality. And he's coming to Great Master Ma. This is a monastery where there were lots and lots of people, very well-trained and very wise and compassionate students, as well as the great and compassionate teacher. And he came to the teacher with this question, and the teacher's response is really important. It's not a flip-off. It's not what it appears to be. Listen to it again. So the monk says, independent of the 4 propositions, transcending the 100 negations, tell me plainly, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? Apart from all that stuff that preoccupies my mind, all the philosophical things, all the ideas about practice, tell me plainly. And Ma, if you listen closely, tells him plainly. plainly. He says, "Today I am tired, and I cannot tell you." That's his answer. It's not, "Go away, little monk, I don't have time for you." It's a direct response. "Today I am tired and cannot tell you." We've been talking in the other talks so far in this Angho about the ordinariness of this great way, the ordinariness of being a human being, the great miracles of Dogen that I mentioned in the first talk I gave. I don't know when that was, maybe yesterday. No, probably. Yeah, it might have been. The great miracles being getting tired, waking up from sleep, turning our heads, hauling water, making tea, chopping wood. These are the great miracles. The minor miracles are all the fancy weird stuff, like fire shooting out of your head and remembering past lives. But the big miracles, "I'm tired today. I can't tell you." We can appreciate Zen Master Ma's plainness. And then he says, and because he knows his students, he says, "Why don't you go ask Jizong about it?" Jizong being one of his foremost disciples. And so the monk, the good monk, the curious, yearning monk, the part of us that really, really wants to know, goes to yet another source outside himself for the answer. We sometimes say that what comes in at the gate is not the family treasure. This is something we have to find out for ourselves, and yet we keep going, we keep looking, we keep trying to find this somewhere. Some of you are very new to Zen, maybe this is your first evening here, and sometimes this stuff just seems so overwhelmingly confusing and complicated. We often get a question from people who are new to the practice: what can I read to help me to understand Zen? And because we're nice people, we'll direct you to reading lists and Amazon and ways to Google certain books. But ultimately, what we hope for is that you'll keep coming to sit, because coming to sit is where you'll learn everything you need to learn. Because in that coming to sit and sitting down and being still and turning towards what's really here, as Dogen said, taking the backward step, really coming to grips with your own heart, your own body, and your own mind. This is the book we read. This is the best book to introduce us to Zen. "So I'm tired today, and I can't tell you. Why don't you ask Jizong?" And the monk goes to Jizong, and Jizong says, "Today I have a headache." I hope you hear the plainness of Jizong's response. It's the same response, just different, because Jizong isn't Ma. Ma is tired, and Jizong has a headache. They're perfectly representing the Dharma in their own bodies, in their own minds, in their own beings. One is tired, and one has a headache. So Jizong says, "I have a headache, and I can't tell you about it." Why don't you ask somebody else? Here's the book list. Here's another person you can go to. Here's another Zen place. Here's another meditation center. Here's another. Here's another. Here's another. Here's another. But the monk, being just like us, says, "Okay, I'll go to Brother High." And Brother High says, "Wow, you know what? Coming to this, I have no clue. I do not understand." Another presentation. Another plain presentation. The monk still hasn't got it. He's still searching. And one thing you need to know is, in Zen, we think of this monk as heroic. He's not a fool. He's not heading on the wrong path, because his yearning is so strong. He keeps asking and asking and asking, going everywhere, going hither and thither. And he finally goes back to the teacher, to Ma, and tells him the whole story. And we can only imagine Ma's delight in his two prized students being so honest, being so forthright, being so plain in their answers. And what he says is, one's head is white and the other's head is black. Which is yet another answer. And this is one of the things we see in the world. One is named Jizong and one is named Baijiang. They're two different people and they give two different answers. But both answers are equal and yet completely unique. Every single one of us in this room is going to discover the truth of our own hearts completely uniquely. You won't find it in any books. You won't find it in any koan stories. You won't hear it from us. You'll hear it in the sound of the wind. You'll feel it in the coolness of the air on your skin. You'll know it because it arises right before you. And no one else in the history of the world will have the exact same awakening or series of awakenings that you have already had and will continue to have. No one. So the introduction to this koan talks about the uselessness of teaching. And yet, I love that Yuan Wu says, and yet you are now listening to me right here preaching. Here it is. The world unfolds itself. If any of this is meaningful to you, then you'll know it because your curiosity will be aroused, your interest, your confusion, or maybe there's something you hear in this that is poignant and direct for you. I'll end with a comment on this koan by one of the translators of this particular koan, Katsuki Sekida, which is one of my favorite comments on this koan. So not only one of my favorite koans, but one of my favorite comments. He's commenting on the line, "This non-preaching and not hearing are worth something." And this is what he says. The sun shines silently. Mountains, rivers, plants, and animals all deliver their silent sermons. Heaven and earth go quietly around, and the universe continues on its course. Thank you. So this is a time for our Dharma dialogue, and please make yourselves comfortable. And this is a chance for you to make comments, ask questions about the koan, about the talk, or about your own practice.
So I come from a place of logic. That's kind of where I've lived my life up to this point. To the point where I want to compare me to a Vulcan. So this whole thing is very, very different for me, which is kind of one of the reasons why it's really intriguing to me. And I recently, a couple of months ago, asked you for a list of books, and I bought about a dozen of them. And the first one I read, I started reading, was Zen Mind Beginner Mind, which is wonderful, and I really enjoyed it. And I haven't read the last chapter. And I haven't touched it in a month and a half. And yeah, so I come to practice.
Because you'll stay in the beginner's mind.
Yeah, exactly.
I never finished it either.
Yeah, and that's a terrific book, and how wonderful. I mean, in a way, you know, we use these books for inspiration. Unique path.
And I think when we get a taste of this, then our genuine curiosity is piqued, not just intellectual. And so it sounds like, you know, the book was helpful and nice, and as you've started practicing, there's maybe a deeper curiosity for the book of your own experience that you're opening every time you sit. So how wonderful to notice those changes.
And I found I kept seeing myself in the book, and mm-hmm. part of the way that it's written, mm-hmm. that out, but it kept coming back to, like you said, the book of me.
The book of you, yeah.
Why do I need this book of someone else?
Yeah.
Thank you,
Matt.
And also this story seems to bring up a theme that's continued in cases of the community of people, you know. So here we have mm-hmm. the teacher and his students, and just being so compassionate toward this monk, you know, knowing what he's seeking, knowing how earnest he is, and together, you know, everyone kind of conspiring to, you know, right. to, you know, help him along. And so it seems, you know, that once you embark on this path, no matter where you are on it, there's always a part of you that's kind of conspiring to help everybody else who has a little bit of interest, you know, like, yes, come along with us. You know, and such a lovely sense of Sangha, because so often I think people feel, you know, isolated in this world and alone, and when they come to this kind of a practice, it opens them up to how much we need each other, and, you know, it's, you know, a very mm-hmm. beautiful part of the case and the mm-hmm. practice. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So, I don't have anything about this talk, but I haven't been here since the beginning of the last Ango.
Oh.
So
wow.
So I remember David said at the opening, so what's your intention? So I remember I had that, like, what's my intention? I've been sitting with that for like the last several months. In fact, I stopped for a while because I thought, well, I don't have an intention. What's the point? Maybe I should stop. And then I would keep going, and, you know, I'd noticed that if I sat, things would get a little better, and my heart would open a little more. And to go back to what Diane said, yeah, it's you do kind of get alone, because then, you know, Zen doesn't make a lot of sense to some people, and then you kind of adopt a perspective that is maybe a little difficult for other people to understand sometimes. But anyway, I was listening to a talk from another teacher the other day from Halifax, Franz Kuhn, or maybe it's backwards. Anyway, and the point was to stop believing in Zen, and the point of the talk was just do it. So I think I kind of found my, and it hit me with something you guys said before, you know, my intention is just show up. That's what you have to do.
Well done. Thank you.
Well, and it's so lovely how you we all think that we have to have some brilliant reason, right? Or just the right purpose or intention, and if we think just right, then we'll get it. But this possibility that it's much simpler than that. You know, oh, just show up.
Just like, I just want to practice.
And sometimes when we cut, it was like what Melissa was saying with these koans, sometimes things appear to us, and like when you say just show up, there's sort of a clarity and a simplicity to it, like in all the answers of these people in the koan. Sometimes we can really feel that. Like it's hard to notice sometimes if we're lost in our thoughts, da, 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 but every once in a while it gets clear. Oh, just show up. And who knows where these insights come from, but we can trust them. Yeah.
And the three other things to do, it's, you know, the instructions in Zen. So these are the four something or others. So show up, sit down, shut up, and don't move. This seems very simple. But everybody knows how hard it is.
So You know, my initial reaction to this koan was that, you know, the teacher was, you know, shoving him off. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, enough. Go ask somebody else. But it also feels like that would have been a wholehearted expression as well. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, what could he have said that wouldn't have been it?
Right. Yeah, exactly. No, it's real. That's a really important point you're making here. Yeah. So everything is it, and some things are more helpful than others, right? And no, this we wouldn't still be telling this story if he hadn't said, "I'm tired." I just think there's something. Oh. But he could have just said, "Get away, kid! You bother me." You know that which sometimes you hear it that way. I heard it that way the first time I heard it. Yeah, but right, this you're making a really important point. I just want to go back to it and underline it. Every response is the perfect expression of the Buddha Dharma. So Diane gave a talk earlier today about the koan, about moving a pillow in the middle of the night. You know, how does Guan Yin use all her hands and eyes? It's like someone moving a pillow in the middle of the night. And we were kind of grooving together on, you know, all the stuff that is... just Buddha Dharma is manifesting all the time. But we don't know it because we're usually looking for it to be in a particular form.
Right.
Right. And the student was definitely looking for it to be in a particular form.
Yeah. And, you know, Diane had mentioned, you know, compassion. Mm-hmm. And for me, I get kind of tangled in what I think compassion is. You know? Mm-hmm. And so that, mm-hmm. that, oh, you know, I'm tired. Mm-hmm. Why don't you ask somebody else? Mm-hmm. For some reason, doesn't feel compassionate. Like, I should really... You know, maybe you should have been sweet. And, but no, that was the compassionate response, right?
Yeah.
I'm tired.
Well, and, you know, the great compassionate response of Jiaozhou, it's important when you're investigating koans with a teacher to realize that the teachers always are being compassionate, even when they appear not to be within our frame. And, you know, so he answers a question that should have the answer yes with no. Deeply compassionate. And, you know, you have to kind of fathom that compassion.
Right.
Yeah.
It reminds me of one Buddhist teacher talks about an exercise to go through a day and imagine that every person you encounter is a bodhisattva and is speaking exactly what you need to wake up. And if only you can understand the great compassionate principle.
No acceptance.
No acceptance. No,
no matter what it appears.
No matter what it is.
So, down here.
Somebody have their hand up?
And next to Derek.
I thought it was interesting that on the one hand, the sort of, you're pushing someone off and saying, no, I'm tired, or I don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned in Master's Pride that people were basically embodying that in the moment, saying, here, this is what I have. And it's funny, you said, what would be the non-compassionate response? It's odd that it is really hard to say, because on the one hand, it feels like giving someone something that might not illuminate, go ask someone else, is mm-hmm. like giving someone a runaround, and it's mm-hmm. going to be fun. But at the same time, that's also it's, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, as you're speaking, I think there is something in Zen about getting people to run around. You know, like, yeah. Like continually saying, "Yeah, look at this, look at that." No, look, and you know that's what we do in Dokusan, where you know you come in with something and you say, and try to come back at you, and then you do that, and then you come back and say, then we give you something, and then you do that, and then finally, you know, there's a point that everybody reaches where they go, "Oh." Right? Yeah.
Yeah. It's like one of those long jokes where you get like distracted by all the other stuff, and then the punchline is that, you know, everything you needed was in the first line. So joke's on you. The joke's on you, but that's why it's so funny and so hopefully, if you're lucky, enlightening.
Well, that is, you're absolutely right, Katie. That's the great joke of Zen. You come on retreats and you get up really early, you don't get enough sleep, and you sit all day and your knees hurt and your ankles hurt and all this stuff and your back hurts, and then what you discover is, has been here the whole time, but you didn't know it because this is the other thing, you were distracted by the other parts of the joke and you're looking for we're all looking for something else. We have fixed ideas about awakening, what awakening is supposed to be like. And we're very, very committed to those ideas. And that's what wears away. Those ideas wear away eventually. And then there's freedom. There's liberation. It's a whole different way of life. Don't believe us, but you can live into it yourself. And you are.
The four thingamajigs and the 100.
Oh, that's the technical term for them. I tried to avoid that.
Well, one was identity, one was being,
non-being.
You said, how do we react? And sounded to me like propositions from a consultant's presentation, having been a consultant and...
you recognized it.
Yeah, and now being a consultant to church, I think consultants often get around to the 100 negations. And so I was going along that route as, dismiss all of that. But then I remembered that I met David at a consultant's meeting.
Well, look what's come of it.
Yes. I found out about countless ways.
And Lynn, thanks for saying that, because, you know, the positive side of this, in Indian Buddhism, almost all of it was orally transmitted. So they did do a lot of the three this's and the four that's and the eight thingamajiggies. And so this is, you know, an oral teaching that got passed down, just like a consultant. I had this image of Nagarjuna getting PowerPoint.
The PowerPoint.
And the first thing that would come up would be existence. Move over into a corner. Non-existence.
You. Both move up.
And then he would do this thing. Like, what really? So you know, these teachings were useful for many people. And could still be. Thank you. Yeah, Derek?
What hooked me was the teacher's response at the end. One's head is white and one's head is black. For me, I thought, you know, he was saying one student's response was correct and one student's response was incorrect. I don't know why I thought the student who had the black head would be incorrect, seeing as everything in Zen is black. But it's just all, you know, so until you said something about it, I was really thrown.
Well,
so it made me feel like, you know, the one who has a black head, the one who said, I don't know, and it seemed like that was a bad thing.
Yeah. Well, you're onto something really important, because there are a lot of koans that set us up like that. You know, there's a famous one where the teacher asks two monks to roll up the blinds, and they do it identically. And he says, one gains, one loses. and the idea being, this is how I always see everything. I judge everything as either good or bad. I've screwed up, and the other person did it right, or vice versa, blah, 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 blah. But Zen is asking us to see beyond gain and loss, beyond black and white, beyond this and that. This happens over and over and over in the koans. There's many, many... there's a great koan where a teacher... goes to a hermit and calls, is anybody home? And the hermit puts up his fist. And the teacher appears to berate him. And then he comes back, and in some translations it's the same guy. Is anybody home? And he puts his fist up and he appears to praise him. And again, it's a sticky trap because we divide the world that way. So to see that another way to divide the world is you and me, Derek and Melissa, cushion and floor, you know, sparrow and crow. Like that one isn't better than the other. They're just unique manifestations of the world. That's how it is. We're not all equal, and we are, and we're unique, and we're all the same. I'm going to shut up now. Yeah. But thanks for bringing that in, because I think that's how often we see that. Christine, I think.
When you said that about the consultant, that's hysterical, because I've been a consultant in and out of my life. And at one point when I was, there was supposed to be these two fabulous consultants who were going to train the consultants. And they came in and they showed us a movie. And, you know, I was thinking, this is just gibberish. I mean, it makes absolutely no sense. And we're supposed to do presentations after. And it was one of the most confusing things I'd ever heard. And then they said, all right, so this is actually very profound. And one of the most important things you're going to take back to your clients. Everybody make a presentation. And they said, do you realize this is the most nonsensical thing? That, you know, what inside of you is going to stand up no matter what the outside does and say, what can be true for you? So I hadn't thought of that in years. And everybody was making these recitations. And nobody understood it, just like the Emperor's New Clothes.
Maybe two last comments. Go ahead.
It reminds me a lot, actually, of what David said earlier, which is if you treat everything everyone says as coming from them.
Yeah.
That, honestly, it's like, even if there had been an intellectual, just seems like you're really missing the point response, the search, the important heroic part of it is that wouldn't have, I don't think would have been sufficient, if even if it had been a lot of, you know, ooh, I have a really complex thing to explain to you, I don't know if it would have mattered. Like, the search was really the key, isn't it? Or is it wrong?
Well, if what we're looking for is everywhere, then wherever we go, there it is. But what it does require, and I think what Zen really emphasizes, is that each one of us has to set off on that search for ourselves, has to look for ourselves. No one else can give us the answer that is already everywhere. So in that sense, it doesn't matter what path or where you look, but to look with an open and sincere heart, like this wonderful monk, this great courageous monk, how many of us are willing to look foolish? Is our heart big enough to be willing to even that for this great matter? Mm-hmm. Yeah, how wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just to add to it, along the lines of what Aaron brought in, and I think you just said this, the searching, this is Aaron, the searching is also a perfect presentation of it. Yeah, it's all, everything is a perfect presentation. So our last comment or question.
I'm just realizing that I'm grateful for how many years I've been on this earth, because I get it. because I used to flip, but the answers are all here right now. Just feeling that gratefulness.
Yeah. Well, so are we. So thank you all. And we'll sit for another couple of moments, a few breaths, and then move into the next portion of our evening.